Becoming a full-time writer can be overwhelming. Join Jay Thorne and Zach Bohannon as they help you improve your craft and find your audience so you too can become a career author. This is the Career Author Podcast.
All right, welcome to another episode of the Career Author Podcast. I'm Zach Bohannon, and with me as always is Jay Thorne. What's up, dude?
Yo, what's up, man?
Nothing much. Just got back from work, riding at the coffee shop for a little bit this morning. My little joint I like going to, most days during the week, especially with it being this hot as it is here. So
yeah, that's good that you have a place to escape to.
Yeah, it's nice. So, but yeah, so, you know, got some words in this morning, so feeling pretty good. So, nice. So what's up with you, man? How are you?
Yeah, revised a shitload today. That's a technical term. It's not a story grid term. It's just, and that always feels good. I always feel like I'm making progress. And as I mentioned over on the Writer's Well podcast, when we did our episode on morning routines, I've sort of changed mine up more recently for one of our projects. And what's really cool is like I've been getting out of bed and like going to the bathroom and getting a glass of water and going straight to my attic. And I do like 20 minutes of meditation, and then I get right on the computer and I aim for 1500 words on this project that we're working on. And what's really awesome about it is I have to finish it before my son gets up, because I have to take him to school. So I can't like fuck around. I gotta like get concentrate on that. But I'm still in that like dreamy, just awake state, you know, like when you just get up and you're sort of, you feel that. Yeah. I like it. Like I kind of like that feeling, and that's what I'm writing in. And it, I don't know, man, like it's really cool. I come back and I just glance at a few paragraphs the next morning to kind of start that day. And I don't even remember typing the stuff. And like, And because it's so early, I already got my words in. Like I got my baseline words in like before the rest of my family's even up. And it's just, I don't know, it's just really motivating. And it's been something I've been, you know, it's been only about 2 weeks, but I love it.
That's awesome.
So, yeah, it's pretty cool.
I wish I could wake up feeling dreamy. So I usually wake up worrying about shit. So I don't do it all the time, but like, I seriously, like a lot of days I wake up and like, there'll be like one thing that like, I shouldn't be stressing about that. It's it's really weird. You know, actually it's funny. I actually gave that trait to one of our characters today when I was writing, because I thought about that. So,
I do that too. And one of the great things about like doing the meditation first is like kind of clear my head, and then I don't look at any messages or anything before I open Scrivener. So I go I go from sleep to meditation to words.
Yeah, unfortunately, I've just decided the meditation thing just doesn't work for me. Like I've tried it. I've tried doing it your way, where you just like, you know, don't have any assistance or anything, and you just stare at a wall. I've tried it using the Headspace app. Like I can't, which, you know, Rachel's been trying to tell me to do. I can't do it. Like I can't, my whole thing where I'm really weird about people like whispering and stuff. And like,
right,
that'll be like, if I'm listening to an audiobook and if the person like talks in a real soft way, like I'll immediately like return the book.
I don't know if this makes a difference for you or not, but in traditional Zazen, if you're sitting open eyed, staring at a wall for a certain amount of time, and you feel like you're not doing it and nothing's happening, you're doing it right. It's weird. Like it took me, I just
can't get my brain to stop.
I don't either. Like I still sit down and every day I fight it. And I still can't go more than 5 or 6 minutes without going off topic. And I have to go blank, and I have to say blank in my head. And it's that process that's like training the muscle. So like at least I don't, in all the years I've been doing it, I still don't sit down and just zone out for 20 minutes. It's still like constant, like pulling back.
I think the other thing I'm fighting with it is the fact that like, you know, every morning routine from successful people you ever hear is like, you hear that always comes up.
Yeah.
You know, I meditate. I just don't enjoy it. And I think that's what I'm fighting is like, I don't enjoy sitting down and doing it.
I don't either.
Like, but like I'm fighting the fact, like if I'm like with a lot of other things, if I don't enjoy them, then I stop doing them.
Yeah.
Like, and you've talked about that. Like I actually, I started journaling and I'm actually enjoying that. Like, I know that you've tried doing that and you didn't enjoy it, so you stopped. So like, why should I treat meditation different? That's kind of my point, is like, if I don't enjoy doing it, then why should I?
I think what's different though, is that it's passive versus active, you know, like, and I don't know, it's hard to explain, but like that feeling of like, I don't like this, it's not working, I'm not doing it right. Like that is basically meditation. And like here's something to consider, and you know, it may not work for you ever, but like what I did with the journaling is I gave myself, I forget what it was, a week or 2 weeks. And I'm like, I'm going to do this no matter what for this amount of time. And like, I wonder if you did that for meditation, or
I've done it and it didn't, like, it was,
you would probably need to do like a month to, you know, I don't know.
I'm sure at some point that I'll try it again. Like I'll read some book and it'll come up again. It'll motivate me to try it. It's difficult for me. So, you know, and I'm usually pretty good at like starting new habits and sticking to them and pretty disciplined with that type of stuff. But that one, it hasn't stuck. So
yeah, over time it does sharpen focus. It does allow you to bring yourself back to what you're working on. But
well, then I guess you'll just be better than me forever. All right. So
welcome to our show on meditation and Zach's resistance.
It's all good. So, but what our show is really about today, I'm actually really excited about today's show. We have titled, or Jay has titled this, The Editor's Six Core Questions. So, we won't get into it too much right this second, but I think this is going to be a good one, and we'll open that up here in a few minutes after we get some other stuff out of the way and do our Jay's Ways and Zach's Hacks this week. Before we get started, I just want to kind of remind everybody about kind of a little thing I threw out last week about my buddy's company, Cadence Coffee. And I'm like, feel really spoiled now because I've been drinking this coffee since I got back from Colorado, and I'm really close to running out, and I'm going to have to order some more soon. So I'm kind of, because I'm spoiled on it. But you know, if you guys are coffee drinkers while you're riding and you want to support a really small business that's run by one of my really good friends and his wife, this dude is a coffee connoisseur. He knows more about coffee than I've probably forgotten about most things. And he's just recently started his own coffee company, my buddy David. So if you guys want to check out Cadence Coffee, David ships anywhere in the US, and it's really cool because he usually will roast on the weekends and then will ship out Monday morning. So the roasted beans come to you as fresh as possible. So he only fulfills orders once a week. So he's able to do that because the dude is also in real estate and property management. So he's got a lot going on, and he has two young kids. So he's got a lot going on.
Yeah.
Just a little bit, but his coffee's amazing. It ships out of Denver. He's even got subscriptions, which is really cool. So if you want to just kind of, if you try his coffee out and you like it, you can subscribe and you can get coffee either once or twice a month. But anyways, I highly recommend checking out and supporting them. If you go on the website, which is cadencecoffeeroasters.com, and Cadence is spelled CADENCE. If you put in the promo code career author at checkout, then you'll get 10% off your first order. So definitely check them out and support them. It's really good stuff. And I love drinking it when I'm at home writing. So we just want to remind everybody about patreon.com/thecareerauthor, where you can get access to all our bonus material for as little as $1 a month, which includes our Amazon product page makeover episode and also our movie analysis, which this month we're going to be doing Dead Poets Society. So you can check out all the cool stuff we're doing over on Patreon at patreon.com/thecareerauthor. And Jay, you want to give a quick reminder about the giveaway we're doing?
Yes. If you are interested in being in the Mark Leslie Lefebvre Memorial Night of the Writing Dead ticket giveaway, all you have to do is comment on last week's episode, which was number 34, Zach. Do you remember which the
well,
exact
like I think that we can keep track, and if people want to comment on this week's, I think that's fine.
Yeah, any of the recent episodes up through September 15th.
Yeah, we'll keep track.
We'll keep track. All you gotta do is leave a comment, And in your comment, let us know what type of topics or things you'd like us to talk about. And if you do that, you'll be entered to win, and we're going to pick one of those people, and you'll get to, as long as you can get to Pittsburgh on your own dime, and either eat or bring your own food, then we have a ticket for you, courtesy of Mark Lefebvre, who unfortunately cannot make it, but is such a great guy, decided he was going to donate his ticket to one lucky winner.
He big-timed us.
He big-timed
us. Little callback to last week. he did big-time.
He did not big-time us. No.
He didn't at all. I don't want that rumor to get out there. Yeah, definitely comment and Jason, let us know what you want us to talk about on the show. We, are very open to topic ideas. So,
right.
Let us know. We're here for you. So, well, cool. Well, why don't we go ahead and jump into Jay's Ways and Zach's Hacks? And
yes,
I need a little jingle for you. Jay's Ways, it's Jay's Ways, or something. I'm terrible.
You would need one too, though. I mean, you couldn't just be for me.
Well, yeah, but you've kind of been hogging them lately, so it's okay. So. Well, less work for me. So Jay, what kind of work do you have for people this week?
honestly, what we try and do with the ways and the hacks is we try and change them up a little bit so that we're not always doing a marketing hack or always doing, productivity. And so we mix them up and what we've been finding, and maybe you guys can let us know what you think of this, is we've been trying, and it doesn't happen all the time, but we try and tie the way or the hack into the main topic. And it worked out again this time because we got a question from Sandy Hutchins. Thank you, Sandy. She asked us, she wanted to know about POV and genre expectations. And I thought this was a great way that would lead into the main topic because I think I might answer it differently than what she expects. So I think what Cindy might have been asking is, what are the genre expectations on commercial genre for, say, third person omniscient? I have a feeling that's where she was going, but I think there's a whole lot more to the question. So I think to answer just the baseline commercial question, I think it's best to know the genre, the commercial genre you want to publish in. So for example, we know that urban fantasy tends to be first person past tense, correct, Zach?
It can. There's present tense too, but yeah, okay. I mean, but first person is definitely important. I think a lot of it is past tense though.
So that's just one example. It doesn't mean you can't write urban fantasy that isn't in first person, but as far as commercial genre, if a reader is really into urban fantasy and they start reading your book and it's not in first person, it's almost like you've got one strike against you.
And the reason why with that genre in particular is because I can talk on that, is that it ties in the fact that another convention for the genre is that your protagonist be kind of snarky. Right. And that's a lot easier to show in first person than it would be in third person, since you're right inside the character's head the whole time.
Yes. So that's one way of looking at POV and genre expectations, but there's a whole bigger piece to this, which is definitely part of some story grid methodology that we're going to get into today. And this is the idea of narrative drive, or as Sean Coyne terms it, narrative altitude. And if you think about the word altitude, what he's basically asking is, how close to the story do you want the reader to be? That is a question around POV and genre expectations. So generally speaking, there are three ways you can think about POV. That would be, or I'm sorry, narrative drive, narrative altitude. That would be suspense, mystery, and dramatic irony. So I'm going to just quickly hit these, and this will be the way. But basically, suspense is when your reader and the character are on the same page, literally. The reader and the character are discovering things at the same time. That is that suspense. And so you could, you have to think about how first person versus third person would work with suspense. What are the pros and cons of using that POV if you want to tell a story that's suspense? The second one is mystery. And this is where the character knows things that the reader doesn't. So just like in the commercial mystery genre, the reader is trying to figure things out, but some characters or some element of the characters know already, right? So that's another way to think of narrative altitude, narrative drive, and how can you deliver a mystery using, you know, first person or second person or third person. And then the third one is, and this is very common in horror movies, so Zach, you'll appreciate this. This is dramatic irony, and this is where the reader knows more than the characters know. So like if you've ever been in the theater and like you're in a horror movie and like, you know, the girl in the bikini from the lake is like going to open the door of the haunted house and everyone's like, no, because we already know like the monster's inside, right? That's dramatic irony. So it's important to consider those narrative drives and think about the altitude and how close do you want the reader to be to the story. And as I said, there's pros and cons for each. So like if you think of, if you think of suspense where the reader and the characters are moving through the story at the same time with the same information, you have to think about how close you want the reader to be. Like, do you want the reader to be looking through the eyes of the character? Maybe that's first person POV. The downside with that is that you can't tell any scenes or chapters from a different perspective. You're kind of locked in. Once you start first person POV, you're kind of locked into that. Now, third person POV puts a little more distance, especially if it's omniscient. You're putting distance between the reader and the character because third person is the outside narrator who's sort of telling you what's happening or showing you what's happening. So you're not as close, but at the same time, now you can do different character POVs. You can move from one character to another and tell the story in different ways. So hopefully that's a way that maybe will help Sandy in determining, you know, commercially, how do you look at POV and then also your narrative drive and what type of story do you want to tell?
Yeah, another that I'll bring up because I almost made this mistake early on. When you're thinking about whether you want to do first person or not, especially past tense, I tried early on. I wanted to do a horror novel like that, and you're kind of giving away to your reader when you do that your main character survives, which always isn't great in the genre because if they're alive to tell the story in past tense or they're telling the story in past tense, it kind of gives away, like, so if you want to kill your main character by the end, make sure you don't use first person past tense because it's much harder to do that.
Yes.
So you want to do first person, you might want to do like present tense or something. So
yeah.
Just a little one from personal experience. So. Cool. Well, way, Jay. So, well, let's go ahead and jump in then to our main topic, which is the editor's six core questions. And I'm excited about this one today. This is something Jay came up with, of course, doing more work. He probably thought about this while he was meditating. So,
well, I did not come up with this. This is StoryGrid methodology. It's Sean Coyne. And if listeners want to know more about sort of StoryGrid or want to go deeper on this, if you go to storygrid.com, there's a ton on each of these six core questions. I thought it was a good craft thing to take a look at today because Sean titled these the editor's six core questions. So what this means is these are questions you need to be asking of your manuscript at some point. I would say, when you ask these questions about your manuscript is a matter of personal choice. However, these would be questions you would absolutely must answer before you either published or you are querying agents or whatever your end goal is. These questions you need to have answered. And I think the earlier you can answer them, the better. However, some you can't answer too soon. And I'll talk a little bit about this.
Yeah. And I think it's important to mention here too, is I know that you're giving this advice from the point of like any writer should be doing this, but
right.
I also do want to throw out there, cause I think this kind of gets overlooked, is that we don't talk about this much on our show, but like Jay is an editor. So like it's part of his profession. Like he, on top of working on books with me and revising my stuff, like Jay has editing clients. So I think that's important to point out because we kind of gloss over that a lot and you're just kind of seen as a writer, but You do, you know, work on manuscripts for editing, so, you know, you have some good experience with this from an editor's perspective, as well as, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about kind of how we answer some of these questions beforehand and all that.
Yeah.
Kind of
stuff as well. Yeah, good point. And, you know, it's, we don't always remember the stuff we do, so I appreciate you bringing that up. But I would also add, too, that, you know, I'm a StoryGrid fanboy, but I also trained under Sean Coyne, so I got it. Yeah. I mean, I got it straight from him, and a lot of this stuff, I feel like I not only use, but I know it really well. And I'm not Sean Coyne, but I can certainly speak to some of these basic elements of StoryGrid. And whether you like the methodology or not, or you find it useful or not, you can basically extract these six core questions and use them standalone, and never look at StoryGrid if you want. It'll still make your story better.
I mean, the six questions we're about to ask, I mean, it doesn't matter if you care about StoryGrid. It doesn't matter if you're a plotter or a pantser. None of that matters. Like, this is about telling a good story. And these are questions that we feel and that Sean feels. Like, these are things you need to know about your story so you don't have a disjointed mess by the end of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, and they're pretty, like a lot of StoryGrid, I think on the surface, they're pretty simple, but they're also really complex at the same time. So let me just rattle off what these six are, and then we're going to go through one at a time and just talk a little bit about them.
All right.
I certainly can't cover them all in one podcast episode, but hopefully this will give people enough information and maybe pique some curiosity, and they'll go check it out on their own. So here are the six questions. What is the global genre? And what we're talking about there are the internal and external story genre, not sales genre, not Amazon categories. The second one is, what is the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff of your global story? Number three, what are the genre's conventions and obligatory scenes? Number four, what is the point of view, narrative devices, forms of narrative drive? A few of those we touched on in the ways. Number five is, what are the objects of desire or character wants and needs? And number six is, what is the controlling idea or theme? So those are the six questions. And Zach, if you're ready, maybe we could start right into these.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and why don't you tell us a little bit about global genre?
Yeah, this is a bit of a gray area, because I'm guilty of using the word genre when I'm talking about commercial genre, but that's different than story genre. And I think when we give some examples, people will understand. So, for example, if you and I write mostly post-apocalyptic dystopian, right?
Yeah.
But that's the commercial genre, but that's not the story genre necessarily, right? Our story genre, we are mostly writing internal genre hero's journey stories set in post-apocalyptic or dystopian settings.
Yep.
So that's the difference. So, like, yes, commercially we write post-apoc dystopian. But the stories we want to tell are hero's journey. Those are the major sort of arch plot, character development, like those, and that hero's journey. You can write a hero's journey genre story in a post-apoc setting, in a romance book, in a high fantasy, in a mystery thriller. Like, it's not specific to commercial genre. And I think, you know, one of the great resources for this is the StoryGrid Clover that Sean came up with. If you Google StoryGrid Clover, you'll see the graphic. And basically, the content genres, the internal ones are worldview, and that's hero's journey. So worldview would be like a theme of education, revelation, maturation, or disillusionment. For us, for another example, our hero's journey stories are almost always sort of maturation or revelation. Our protagonists at the end are fundamentally different people because of the trials and tribulations they've gone through. And that would be a revelation or a maturation. You also have an internal genre of status. And this would include stories that are about with the theme like sentimental, pathetic, tragic, admiration. This is not something I'm very familiar with, but these are the types of stories where you feel a certain way at the end, right? You can feel sentimental or pathetic or admiration, or it can be a tragedy. And then you have the morality story. This is the internal genre. And this is where you get into punitive redemption, testing, triumph, surrender. So like the internal morality story could be like a hiker on a mountain who gets stranded and somehow overcomes, you know, he wants to lay down and die, but like pushes on and like surrender and like is triumphs in the end. The internal genre for that story could be morality, while the external genre could be an action film or an action story, right? So those are the three internal: status, worldview, morality. Then you have the external content, and these are going to sound more familiar, and some of these are going to cross over into commercial genre. So these are things like the war story, love story, thriller, crime story, horror story, action adventure, the Western, the performance. These are external genres. Now, ideally, you would like to be able to layer an external genre and an internal genre in one story, but not always. So, for example, James Bond, that is purely external genre. That is those are action stories. James Bond doesn't go through a major transformation in each film. He's basically the same guy in the beginning as he is in the end. That's a very quick overview of story genre versus commercial genre. What I'm calling story genre is also known as global genre, and the overarching genre of the type of story you want to tell.
For us, I will say that this is when we're starting a new series, like this is one of the first questions we ask. We did that recently with our flagship series that we're planning. Like when we start out talking and we were kind of getting confused, not confused, but like there's a lot of stuff going around. Then you kind of were like, okay, stop. Let's figure out what the internal and external genre was. And that kind of puts us on the right path. So this is one thing in these six questions that we kind of figure out ahead of time.
Yes.
You know, that we feel like it saves us some time and gives us some guidance along the way. So,
yeah. And it's the thing that StoryGrid editors will, if you work with a StoryGrid editor, will hammer you on. They will, what is the story you want to tell? And it doesn't have to do with post-apoc or space opera. It is what type of story do you want to tell? And that's why it's really important.
Cool. All right. All right. Let's go. So we'll go ahead and jump to the next one, which is what is the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff? Which, again, this is another example of one that for each book, this is something that you and I kind of figure out before we start writing the book and plan ahead with.
Yes, it is. And generally speaking, we're talking about a 3-act structure. You and I believe that is the only structure, and anything other than 3-act or variations on it. If you can boil story down to its pure essence, it is a beginning, middle, and end. I mean, that it's pretty fundamental. The beginning hook, roughly speaking, is 25% or so of your story. This is where you present the expectations of the story, or you set the table, so to speak, for what the reader is going to get, what type of story this is going to be. The middle build is the middle 50% of the story, and this is where you are building, literally building. You're building the tension, you are building the obstacles that the protagonist faces, the stakes get higher, and it's building towards the ending payoff. And this will be the final 25%. And this is where you resolve all of those tensions that you're building. It is where you answer the questions that you are raising in the beginning hook. And hopefully, if you do it well, you're doing it with what Sean would say would be a surprising yet inevitable ending. And those are the most satisfying. And it's really that simple. Now, you can go into the Russian doll granulation the way Sean does, and you can look at beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff for each act. You can do that for each chapter, for each scene. I mean, you can go really in the weeds on this, but basically, for your global story, at some point you have to answer the question of what is the beginning hook, what is the middle build, and what is the ending payoff.
Absolutely. Yeah, and like I said, this is something that we kind of because we're heavy outliners, so this is something we kind of figure out, and we write our outlines. We write them that way. Like, we have our beginning hook, which will always have some kind of call to action in it, and as well to kind of get our hero thrusted into the middle build, which is progressive complication upon progressive complication in the middle build and kind of leading up to our ending payoff. So,
and it's really a simple question to ask. A great example, because everyone knows this, and my mother loved this movie, so I've seen it, no joke, dozens of times. But Wizard of Oz, the beginning hook is Dorothy gets whisked away in a tornado to Oz. The middle build is she's trying to get home, and the ending payoff is, spoiler alert, she does.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said it like that, because like this, you know, I know that I just said like, you know, this is how we do our structure outlines and stuff, but really you can break this down, like, even if you're a pantser or whatever, like you can break this down to one sentence, like yeah. Jay just did, like your beginning hook, like you can put what happens your beginning hook in one sentence. You can do that with your middle build and your ending payoff. Like you, three sentences, you can tell your entire story.
Yeah.
Like the main points that are going to happen.
Yeah. And that's what you need to be able to do with your manuscript, whether you plotted it or pantsed it. Some point you have to be able to identify those three things. If you can't, you know, you've got a problem with your story.
Absolutely. All right, so we'll go ahead. Three. Yeah, so what are the genre conventions and obligatory scenes?
Okay, this is people get really confused with these terms, and they're not as complicated as you think they are. So, like, conventions are reader expectations for the type of global genre story that you want to tell. So, for example, a convention to the hero's journey would be the mentor figure, the mentor archetype, right? If you look at Star Wars, you got to have Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? You need, because, you know, with Luke, you know, he's this firebrand, this young kid, he doesn't know what he's doing. The convention of the hero's journey story is having that mentor archetype in it. So it's not a scene, or it's not something specific like a story beat. It's just part of the global genre that the reader or the viewer would expect.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that can be something like just identifying a person. It could be like a convention of post-apoc is like a ruined landscape, urban landscape, right? That's a convention. Someone who likes post-apoc in a commercial genre would be expecting that in the story, basically.
Absolutely.
Now, the obligatory scenes are specific moments within the story that a reader would also expect. So again, if we use the hero's journey because it's what we're most familiar with and have used most, there is the dark night of the soul, or the all is lost moment would be an obligatory scene. So in your story, if it is a hero's journey global genre story, you must have a moment where the reader thinks it's all over. And the character thinks, I'm done. There's no way out of this. There's no hope. It is all is lost, literally. And you got to have that. And if you don't have that, a reader's not going to say, oh, my goodness, you missed an obligatory scene. They're just going to bail, or they're going to be like, I don't know. It didn't work
so
for me.
Can you give an example of a good all is lost moment for our listeners?
Let's see. What would be a good all is lost moment? How about Star Wars, since I started with that example, where Luke loses his hand.
Yeah, so that, yeah, in Empire Strikes Back, that's the one that came to mind for me. Yeah,
that would be a moment where, you know, you think it's done, he's lost his hand, it looks like he's going to be beat by Vader, and I think Vader killed Obi-Wan right before that, right?
Well, yeah, he killed Obi-Wan in the first movie.
In the first, right,
which
yeah.
Which is probably the all is lost moment in that movie, I would say. Like, it's maybe not, but I don't know.
I don't remember it well enough to say. I think what's important too is that those obligatory scenes have to come from the perspective of the protagonist.
Yeah, that's why I hesitated to say that.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily the worst thing that happens in the story. It's the moment where the main character appears to be absolutely hopeless.
Well, he did lose his mentor. But
yes.
I still know what you're saying, though.
Yeah.
So, anyways, I think the one in Empire Strikes Back, though, is a better example where Darth Vader takes his hand off.
And yes.
Think it's over. So.
Right. Cool. So that's basically it for conventions and obligatory scenes. I would just say that the conventions are almost always both commercial genre and global genre specific. And if you have to ask what they are, you probably haven't read enough in that genre yet.
Yeah.
You should know them. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep.
So, okay, so we'll go ahead and move on. What is the point of view, narrative devices, forms of narrative drive?
Yeah, this was the way. So I think I'm going to sort of gloss over this one, but I would just, reiterate that, the way you're telling the story is suspense, mystery, or dramatic irony. So you have to figure out how are you going to unfold this global and commercial genre, and then that should then inform how close you want the reader to be, which then helps you decide whether it's first person, second person, or third person.
Good stuff. So what are the objects of desire or character wants and needs?
These are fun. Sean uses something called the gas gauge. It's a visual representation if you think of empty versus full in your gas in your car and your gas tank. But and he goes really into Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You can get really specific on this. You can look at sort of basic primal needs like food and water and sleep. And then you can make your way up Maslow's hierarchy to the top of the pyramid, which are things like self-actualization. And the basic theory for Maslow is that you have to satisfy the base needs before you can move up the pyramid. So nobody cares about having someone that they love if they're starving to death, right? You have to satisfy those basic needs, and then you can move up the pyramid and you'll have these grander needs, right? But for the purposes of story, what's really important is identifying wants versus needs, which are almost never the same thing. So if you think about it this way, what the character wants is what they might explicitly say. But we know as the reader, or more accurately as the author, it's not what they say they want, it's what we know they need, right? So someone can say, I want to be alone. But what they really need is a partner that they can trust for their rest of their
life. Absolutely. That's a great example.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think it's really important. You and I do this, and it's very simple. It usually doesn't take long. If it takes long for you to figure this out, something's wrong. But basically, looking at your main characters, your protagonist, also your antagonist, that's really important as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because if you don't, you don't want just a mustache-twirling villain who is two-dimensional with no depth. And the way you create a villain with some depth is you think about the wants and needs of the villain through their perspective.
Because they're the hero of their own
story.
That's
right. That's right. They are. So if you can identify wants versus needs for all of your main characters, then they'll always be motivated in the right direction, and they're more likely to do things in the story, whether you plan them or not. They're more likely to do things that are consistent with their character if you've identified what they want and what they need.
Absolutely, because anytime you have to make a decision, or your character has to make a decision, aka you're making a decision for them as you're writing it, you can come back to that. Like,
yes,
you come back to what their wants and their needs are, what their object of desire is, and like, you know, if you know all those questions going in, like, or you know those things, then it makes answering questions like that easier. If your character comes across a scenario where, you know, are they going to kill this person? Or are they not? Are they going to steal this thing? Or are they not? Like, you know, you'll know, it'll help you answer that question and keep your character consistent.
Yes. Yes. And we don't believe in having a dossier on each of our characters where we write down their third grade teacher and their favorite color and what they had for breakfast. And I know some authors love that, and I think that's fine. I personally think it's a form of resistance. I think it's a way of not writing. The reason we don't do that is because if you have your characters' wants and needs specific and you stay consistent with them, then that will then reveal the character, and you don't have to build out all of those specifics.
Yeah, those are small things that if it happens to come up in the story, you can just make a note of it along the way.
Right.
Add to your character sheet. So,
yeah.
Cool. So the last one we've got here is, what is the controlling idea or theme? And I think I could pretty safely say that this is one that you and I do not write down before we start writing the book.
No.
This is something we kind of find along the way if we're even looking for it.
Yeah. And I will also mention Stephen Pressfield, any of his stuff. He has a lot on controlling idea or theme, because it's really, as Sean would say, it's super squishy. But, you know, basically, it's, what is your story about? Like, what type of message are you trying to send? What statement are you trying to make about yourself, about people, about society? And this is really hard. And it's not usually something you can plan ahead of time. It's usually something that evolves as the manuscript evolves. And it's, you know, it can be really simple, but it's also really hard to identify it. So I'll give you an example of a controlling idea or a theme. Good guys finish last, right? Like, that could be a theme, right? Like, you could have a tragic story where someone does all the right stuff and they lose. And that would be a bummer of a story. But, like, you could write that story. If you wanted to make a statement and said, like, you know what, in this day and age, you should be selfish. You should only do what you want to do. You should only be looking out for yourself, because everyone who tries helping other people gets screwed, right? And, like, whether you believe that or not, like, that's a legitimate controlling idea or theme. Like, that could be something, that could be the message you want to tell. I think for, if I can be so bold, Zach, I know we haven't really discussed this a ton between us. I feel like a lot of our stuff, we have a controlling idea or theme that runs through all of our stuff. I think it has to do with this idea of redemption and sort of rising up to meet the challenge. It seems like most of the characters we create, and we don't do this consciously, we don't do this in our character bio dossier that we fill out, but when I look back at our stories, they're usually about a person who made a mistake and kind of gets a second chance, or an average person who has to, like, pull it up by the bootstraps and, like, put the big girl or big boy pants on and do shit that's not great and they didn't think they could do, but in the end they do it. And I think that's something that comes out in a lot of our stories.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of an overlying theme in everything we've done so far. So
yeah, you know. And I think that's important to recognize. Like I said, we haven't even talked about it explicitly, and it's not something like that we're working into our outline, but it's something we keep in mind, and I think it sort of colors the way we reveal character. And as Sean likes to say, you don't tell people about the character. You don't give them the worksheet that shows them how much they weigh and what their hair color is, but you reveal their character through their actions. And yeah. And if you know sort of the controlling idea or theme, and you know the character's wants and needs, it becomes really easy to reveal that character through the choices that he or she makes.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at look at The Walking Dead, like, on the surface, it's like, if it's, you're like, oh, it's a show about zombies. It's like, no, it's really not. it's really, like, when you really look at the theme, it's really about, like, the decline of humanity in a hopeless situation.
Yeah.
It, you know, is really what it's about, you know? So,
yes, definitely.
Yeah. So I think that's kind of a good example. So.
And it's, you know, it could have a bit of a tragic theme. I mean, if you're looking at it through the perspective of Rick Grimes, you know, he starts out as a cop with a family and everything's cool. And like, it's a story of him, like, just struggling in this world where there's no laws and no rules, and he's got to do shit that he didn't think you'd ever have to do, and he doesn't feel great about it. And it's kind of a tragic story, but it's also a statement on, like, what would happen if we removed society's laws and rules. Like, what would happen? And that's the theme I think that show explores.
And then they changed writers and showrunners.
Oh, shit. Oh, we won't get, that's a whole nother episode.
I know. but yeah, so those are the six questions, the editor's six core questions. I knew I was gonna get it right eventually. And I mean, those are great questions. And I mean, you know, those are, like, in our opinion, like, if you want to tell a good complete story, like, these are six questions that you should know the answers to, you know.
Yes.
By the time your book is ready to publish, like, you should be able to answer all these questions. So, yeah. Anything else you want to add before we jump out of here?
I would, again, just encourage people to head on over to storygrid.com and just use the search box if you want to know about the six core questions, or about one specifically, or more about narrative drive. There's a ton of blog posts from StoryGrid editors, from Sean and Tim. There's a ton of great resources there that are free. Use them. They'll definitely make your stories better.
And just a reminder, the podcast is not affiliated with them in any way. No. It's just something that we totally believe in. So we're not throwing out a promo code or anything for you.
No, there's no affiliate play here or anything.
but speaking of promo codes, go over to cadencecoffeeroasters.com, throw in career author in the promo code box, and get 10% off your first order. Woo-hoo. Another thing we're not getting paid for, but I'm just trying to help my buddy out because his coffee's awesome and he works his ass off to do it. So
nice.
Man, thanks everyone as always for listening. Just a reminder as well to check out all the stuff we're doing over at Patreon at patreon.com/thecareerauthor. And we've also got our Night of the Writing Dead contest going on. So drop comments, let us know what you want us to talk about on the show. And there's still live tickets available. If you want to come and join us, you want to buy a ticket, then you can still do that at nightofthewritingdead.com. The virtual ticket option is no longer available, but if you want to come join us live, that option is definitely available. So, So with that, I believe that will bring our show to an end this week. So we appreciate everyone listening as always. Tell your friends about us, all that good stuff, so they'll come over and jump and listen. And we will talk to you guys next week.
Bye. Later.